Okay, so what we're going to do now is that third part that we kind of skipped over, because I definitely wanted to deal with the issue of the evangelism and so on and focus on that for a minute. But now we're going to go back to what originally was the third part, and that was the third part of four.
Do we have to remember the sequences?
No. And this is where we get to deal with Islam's challenge to America.
You want to hit it?
It'll come up eventually, I think. Oh, yeah. And we're going to talk also about Islam and the concept of jihad. Remember these guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Osama bin Laden over there, this was Ahmadinejad leading Iran for a while. The great parades that they have, death to America, death to Israel, the big Satan and the little Satan, America and Israel. How did we get where we are today in our country and in this global war that we are involved in? Whether we want to admit it or not, this is a world war in many respects. It's not as hot, it's not like the other world wars, but it's certainly there. The tension seems to be rising in many areas. But remember, how did we get here? You have to remember, the life of Muhammad sets the pattern. Muhammad, the perfect man. What Muhammad did, a good Muslim will do. Muhammad, in the Hadith, tells how certain cases should be adjudicated. Well, what did Muhammad do? Muhammad followed the way of jihad, which is simply a word that means holy war. Jihad is simply holy war or struggle. It is taught in the Quran. Chapter 2, verse 190. Fight in the way of Allah against those who fight against you, but begin not hostilities. Lo, Allah loves not aggressors. Well, that seems to say that you're justified to defend yourselves. If somebody attacks you, you are authorized to fight back and defend yourselves. Fight against them. Fight in the way of Allah against those who fight against you. The problem is, it's very easy to justify that you are being attacked. Many radical Muslims that want to justify current jihad will say, when the United States stationed troops in Saudi Arabia, going back to the first Gulf War, they were trespassing on the land of the Prophet. They had invaded. They call us the invaders. The invaders are just like the crusaders of old, are invading the land of the Prophet, and Islam is under attack because we station troops in Saudi Arabia. And therefore that justifies jihad. Okay, they can rationalize that, and they have, right, and many have rationalized it by such reasoning. Chapter 66, verse 9, O prophet, strive against the disbelievers and the hypocrites, and be stern with them. Hell will be their home, a hapless journey's end. Well, the good Muslim will speed that journey along. And that's at least some teaching. Remember, the vast majority of Muslims, you might say, are not really into this. Maybe they have developed alternative interpretations. Maybe they see jihad as metaphorical. And there are some schools of Islamic interpretation that see all of this as metaphorical language that is not literally to be carried out. But we're seeing the rise of violent jihad. We're seeing this phenomenon more and more. The nation of Turkey just took a vote where they gave their prime minister, president, whatever he is, vast increased measures of power. And he is a committed Islamist. And so Turkey, which is a NATO member, is slipping away further and further into the militant camp. That's going to create a problem in NATO. Strive against the disbelievers and the hypocrites. Strive against them. Fight. There's justification there for jihad. You have to remember, and because we are so bad at knowing history, we are in our nation, You ever watch those TV shows where they go about and they, you know, they go to spring break somewhere and they interview kids on the beach, college students on the beach, and they give them basic questions about American history, American government, and they're, well, of course, they're half drunk. What do they know? It's just that we're sitting there going, we're so ignorant. We don't know our history. We don't know the history of Islam. Nobody who knows the history of Islam can fall for that statement that Islam is a religion of peace, because Islam, throughout its history, from its very beginning, with the exception of certain brief periods, has been a religion of war. And it has been promoted and expanded largely through warfare. The history of Islam is very violent. In Muslim tradition, the world is divided into two houses, the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam, and the Dar al-Harb, which is the House of War. By the way, communism had the same division. There was the realm of peace and the realm of war. And the realm of peace were the nations that were under the dominion of communism, and then the world or the realm of war were the nations that still had to become communist. Islam preceded communism by a long time, but it has also this concept. The world is divided into these two spheres, the House of Peace, which are the nations that have already submitted to Islam and adopted Sharia, and the House of War, which are the nations that are yet to be conquered and brought under conquered militarily if needed, but, you know, persuaded through persuasion or something like that. The rest of the world will come to adopt Islam. I was talking out at dinner. Islam does have an eschatology. And in that eschatology... My daughter's birthday is April 24th. That's my reminder. Becca's birthday.
Excuse me.
Wow. I'm sure glad that popped up in the middle of everything. In Islamic Islam, eventually the whole world will be united under the authority of Sharia and committed to following the teachings of the Prophet. Here's just a map of Islamic conquest, and this is very instructive. In three different areas of this map, this area here, which is Saudi Arabia and the countries that are down here on the lower end of the Arabian Peninsula, is the land that was conquered under Muhammad during his lifetime, and this was by armed conquest. This was not evangelism. This was armed conquest. That took place from the year 622 to the year 632, 10-year period. In 10 years, Muhammad went from his initial victories in Medina to his victories in Mecca, and then expanded his influence through the whole Saudi Arabian Peninsula. He didn't call it Saudi Arabia. We'll get to that. But the Arabian Peninsula. And this was the area that was Muslim at the time of the death of Muhammad. From 632 AD to 661, that's about 29 years, Islam expanded into this brown area here, lighter brown area. 29 years, Islam conquered that area. And again, it was by military conquest. Following that, under the caliphate of the Umayyad Caliphate, the Rashidun Caliphate, the Umayyad Caliphate from 661 to 750, That's what, 90 or 89 years or so. Islam expanded into these green areas. Notice it goes all the way up to into Spain. The Arabic or the Islamic name for Spain is Andalusia. You ever heard of an Andalusian horse? The Arabs actually were great horse breeders. And the Andalusian is a beautiful horse. And I actually kind of like the sound of that name, Andalusian. But I'm not saying we should. But a Muslim dreams of the day when Spain will once again be called Andalusia and will be brought back into the caliphate. And that the caliphate will once again spread as far as it did under the Umayyad Caliphate, which is I won't say it's the largest. Now, the conquering of Spain, you ever see that old movie El Cid? Remember El Cid? That deals with a Spanish leader who fought back against the Muslim advance and eventually defeats the Muslims, even though he's dead. But he rides his horse into the battle, even though he's dead already. Okay. Who was the actor?
Charlton
Heston. Yeah. Yeah. I still think of him as Moses. But anyway, they did go out into Portugal, what is today Portugal and Spain. But in Spain, they started rolling, the Europeans started rolling back the Muslim expansion. And so this is at least as far as their expansion into the west of Europe. Islam is finally stopped in Spain and then eventually rolled back. But it does eventually... even though it's beyond this period of time, Islam eventually does come over here. Here's Constantinople, which becomes what? Istanbul. And so on. That's up here in this area. So eventually, beyond this period of time, Islam still does expand up here into at this point here and so on. There's still a little more expansion to take place. But this is from 622 to 750 AD. That's how much Islam expanded during that period of time. And it was, again, largely through military conquest. What about our jihad's threat to America? I mentioned before that America actually does have a long history in dealing with this. Thomas Jefferson was the first president who actually had to confront were the Barbary. The Barbary pirates were the jihadists of their day. And they had a practice of capturing ships and then demanding ransom from the nations. And they captured several American ships. And for the first few American administrations, we paid ransom to the Barbary pirates to get our sailors and our ships back. But at some point, there was... And we said, no, we can't keep doing this. Can't stop, can't keep paying ransom. The more you pay the ransom, the more it encouraged the pirates to take more ships, and the ransom went up and up and up. So Thomas Jefferson actually asked Sidi Haji Abdrahman, by what right the Barbary pirates captured American ships and held their crews for ransom or sold them as slaves? And he was told that this right... was founded, and this is actually from historical material. This right was founded on the laws of the prophet, that it was written in their Quran that all nations should not have who should not have answered their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners, and that every Musulman or Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. This is what Jefferson writes about his conversation with this man who was a representative from North Africa. By what right do you claim, do you think you can capture our ships and hold our sailors hostage and sell them into slavery and demand ransom? And this is still the justification for jihad. This is still a justification for holy war carried on through violent means. And we dealt with this. This is the Marine hymn. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of
Tripoli.
North Libya. Libya. That's Tripoli was where the Barbary pirates, the Marines, actually came into being when our administration said enough is enough. They sent a squadron of ships over with Marines aboard, and they made a demand. We want the Sultan dead or our sailors alive. It's going to be one or the other. You make the choice. And we got the ships and the men back. But that was our earliest experience with violent jihad and with Islam. John Quincy, any of you ever read, David McCullough's book on John Adams? You ever read that? I thought that was a wonderful book. It was a great book. Not strictly a biography. I mean, there's a lot that's kind of
supposed in there and added in.
But it is a fascinating book. And I think they made an HBO series on it or something like that. Very good. John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, who also served a little after his father as president of the United States, wrote this about Islam. Can you imagine an American president saying this today? In the 7th century of the Christian era, a wandering Arab of the lineage of Hagar the Egyptian, combining the powers of transcendent genius with the preternatural energy of a fanatic and the fraudulent spirit of an impostor, proclaimed himself as a messenger from heaven and spread desolation and delusion over an extreme portion of the earth. Adopting from the sublime conception of the Mosaic law, the doctrine of one omnipotent God, he connected indissolubly with it the audacious falsehood that he was himself his prophet and apostle. Adopting from the new revelation of Jesus the faith and hope of immortal life and future retribution, he humbled it to the dust by adapting all the rewards and sanctions of his religion to the gratification of the sexual passion. We haven't even touched Islamic teaching on women. I'm taking a sidebar here. It amazes me that so many American liberals who are so committed to feminism will blindly say we can be at peace with Islam. They either are, I believe they are willfully ignorant of what Islam actually teaches about the religion, about a man's treatment of his wife, and about the role of woman, of a woman in Islamic society. The fact that American liberals can say, yeah, we should accept this, and so on. Meanwhile, if you're a Christian, you're a sexist, and you're all kinds of evil things. By the way, you ever heard that expression, rule of thumb? Mm-hmm. You know where that comes from? Mm-hmm. A Muslim husband can beat his wife with a stick as long as it's not bigger than his thumb. As long as it's not thicker than the man's thumb, he can beat his wife with that stick. That's what a rule of thumb is. Okay. Ladies, make you feel warm and fuzzy there. Okay. What does Paul write about husbands and wives? Love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. So, okay. Kind of, you know, great contrast there. Where are we here? He humbled it to the dust by adapting all the rewards and sanctions of his religion to the gratification of the sexual passion. He poisoned the sources of human felicity at the fountain by degrading the condition of the female sex and the allowance of polygamy. And he declared undistinguishing and exterminating war as a part of his religion against all the rest of mankind. The essence of his doctrine was violence and lust, to exalt the brutal over the spiritual part of human nature. Between these two religions, Christianity and Islam, thus contrasted in their characters, a war of 1,200 years has already raged. The war is yet flagrant. While the merciless and dissolute dogmas of the false prophet shall furnish motives to human action, there can never be peace on earth and goodwill toward men. That wasn't a president of the United States of America that wrote that. Can you imagine that being spoken or written today? That was John Quincy Adams. I kind of think he nailed it. In the present day, I'm just going to take you some of our more recent history. A little trip down memory lane. February 26, 1993, the first bombing of the World Trade Center in New York. 6 dead, 1,040 injured. June 25, 1996, a group of 13 Saudi and Lebanese members of Hezbollah set off a truck bomb at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia. 19 dead, hundreds injured. March 23, 1997, a Palestinian terrorist shoots several people at the top of the Empire State Building. 1 dead, 6 injured. August 7, 1998, bombing of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. 223 dead, 4,085 wounded. March 17, 2000, an imam in Atlanta shot a deputy sheriff and his partner. 1 dead, 1 wounded. October 12, 2001, bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen, 17 killed, 39 wounded. September 11, 2001, Islamic terrorists hijacked four planes, two hit the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, one hits the Pentagon, the fourth crashes in western Pennsylvania after the passengers try to regain control of the plane. 2,976 killed, 304 wounded. 2004, there are three separate terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia, 30 dead. November 5, 2009, a Muslim army psychiatrist guns down 13 unarmed soldiers at Fort Hood, Texas, while yelling praises to Allah, 13 dead, 31 wounded. September 11, 2012, Benghazi, Libya, four Americans killed by a group associated with Al-Qaeda. That was not a spontaneous demonstration against a video. April 15, 2013, Boston, Massachusetts. Two radicalized brothers set off bombs at the Boston Marathon. Three dead, 260 injured. In Paris the same year, twice terrorist attacks took place. In San Bernardino, California, shooting during a Christmas party at a government office. Just in the month of September, this is when I originally wrote this, so it was in that September, we've seen 175 attacks by Islamic jihadists that has resulted in 1,093 deaths and 1,303 injuries. See, we tend to focus on only the things that happen in America or that happen in, say, France or England or something, or even Spain. But these things are happening all around the world every day. Most of them never make our news. Yes?
Haven't they threatened the coal again?
The coal is back on duty, and I think there was a threat made to the coal again. It's back on duty in the Middle East, and there was a threat to attack it again somehow. Since 9/11/2001, there have been over 29,349 deadly attacks by Islamic terrorists. Again, you do not hear about the vast majority of them because they take place in, out of the way. Well, countries that are off our radar screen, put it that way. But they include the bombing of churches, like we saw over Easter time in Egypt, the Coptic church that was bombed, churches that were bombed. They include things like that. I got these statistics from a website called www.religionofpeace.com. Ironic name. But they actually track all of the attacks in real time around the world. And so they are a good, the number is actually far greater now. This figure is about a year old or so. And I think I updated this when I did it at Presbytery. So, that Presbytery meeting was last October. So there's many more now. But think of it, 29,000... 349 attacks since 2001. That was 15 years, 15-year period. Over 29,000 attacks. Why is Islam so violent? Why is the United States the main target of Islamic terrorism? And we've always heard, it's because of something we've done, because we're the aggressor. Because of our foreign policy, is it something because of what we've done, or is it because of the rise of Islamist extreme ideology? Again, this word of caution: there are still many Muslims who have no desire to overthrow Western democracies, but there is a growing Islamist movement that does seek to impose Sharia, the path, on all nations. Somewhere between 10 to 20% of Muslims have been radicalized at this time. Take that 1.6 billion figure, and what's 10% of it? What's 20%? Somewhere in there is the number of radicalized Muslims that will justify in their own minds the path of violent jihad, and will tune into these websites and these broadcasts and so on, and they will make their trips to Pakistan or Yemen and be radicalized there, come back more devout, and so on. And that's where the danger is. I would have to caution this. There's kind of this, on the one hand, on the other, I feel like Tevye from Fiddler on the One Hand, on the other. Okay, 10 to 20% have been radicalized. But among that 90 to 80% left, even though they're not radicalized, which means they're willing participants, they still support a great number of that 80 to 90% still theoretically support the concept of violent jihad. Even though they may not be willing to participate in it, there's still a lot of support for it in this 80 to 90% who are not radicalized yet, which means they're still capable of being radicalized. The threat is real, and the threat is there. The traditional way that we have come to think about Muslims as radical and moderate is not valid, and that's because even moderate Muslims, they themselves do not participate in violent jihad, still will say that it's justified, and still will say we want to work for that day when the whole world is brought under an Islamic caliphate and follows the path and lives in submission. That's still the goal. They still want that goal. They may not be committed to the violent means to achieve that goal, but they still want that goal. So you have to be careful. It's so complex sometimes. The Islamist movement is divided between those who carry on violent jihad by holy war and those who want to achieve the same goals at the present time through nonviolent means. But the goal is still the same. Many so-called moderates are, in fact, in this second group. Same goal, different tactics. And this is where, okay, you're a moderate Muslim. That means you're okay? Okay. I'm not actually scared you're going to, you know, shoot me. But I am concerned because you still have the same goal. And that means you're still possibly be radicalized in the future. Or you'll still be working in some other way toward that goal. What are some of the movements that shape modern Islamic jihadism? There are different schools of thought, not the Sunni-Shia division, but in the course of history, there have developed certain movements, and these are what we call reform movements. One of them is Wahhabism, which is localized in the Arabian area. That's where its origins are, and that's where its main influence is. The royal family of Saudi Arabia supplies multitudes of people and vast amounts of money. Ooh, those were good beans. They supply vast amounts of money and people to establish Wahhabist-oriented schools called madrasas and Wahhabist-oriented mosques, even in the United States. And our friends are still funding our enemies. And then there's the Salafist movement, which is focused mainly in Egypt. These two movements have shaped the modern Islamic movement. There's also the historical Muslim opposition to the nation of Israel. That continues to be a very a real trigger of violence and hatred. Remember, the United States is the big Satan, and Israel is the little Satan. The Islamic Revolution in Iran, which took place back in the 70s, is a source of Shia Muslim terrorist activity. In Islam, or the regime in Iran, is the main sponsor of Hezbollah, which means the army of God, or the army of Allah. And they are a very prominent, well-known terrorist group. They are sponsored largely by the government of Iran. The Arab Spring. Wasn't that Arab Spring going to be great? We're going to get rid of all those nasty dictators that infested the Middle East, and they were all going to become wonderful nations committed to the peaceful resolution of problems and so on. They were going to be free societies. And you know what? Almost every country that was involved in the Arab Spring, the Islamist parties won vast amounts of influence in those countries. And so the Islamic Spring has actually become a disaster for us. You remember Egypt? Egypt was part of the Islamic Spring, or the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring. Egypt was part of the Arab Spring. And they had free elections. They threw out that dictator, Hosni Mubarak, and they had elections. And guess who won the elections? Remember? The Muslim Brotherhood. And they immediately instituted harsh penalties against all their enemies, started imprisoning people. It, fortunately for us, they were terrible administrators. And so the Egyptian people, within a couple of years, had another revolution where they demonstrated and eventually kicked out the Muslim Brotherhood and brought in the military. So now Egypt is under a military government. And the people are, in fact, doing quite well. Okay, it's not a democracy. But that doesn't mean there's not a problem with the militant groups yet, but in Egypt, but their situation has somewhat stabilized. But as a result of the Arab Spring, Muslim Brotherhood actually took over Egypt for a while. We saw the descent of Libya into chaos, and the situation in Libya where ISIS, the rise of ISIS is a direct result of the Arab Spring. Took us by surprise in many respects. We helped overthrow corrupt secular governments, and many of them were replaced by Islamic regimes. And the rise of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which is Al-Qaeda has in many parts of the Middle East morphed into ISIS. Some people will say that the two organizations are in competition with each other. Yeah, possibly, but there's still a relationship between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. There's a kind of a parent-child relationship, and sometimes the children can get a little feisty and so on. Again, how did we get here? Let's go back and look at Wahhabism. Founded by a man named Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, Naji, in the 1740s. This goes back a few centuries. It's a reaction against the growing influence of different schools within Islam. Islam began to be fractured with different interpretive schools. If you will, different denominations, different interpretive schools. We have different seminaries, and they have different emphases and so on. Islam had become fractured. There are different schools of thought, different emphases, different groups forming within, even beyond the Shia-Sunni split, but there's different groups. And Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab Naji wants to correct that situation, and so he seeks to reform Islam by honoring the authority of the original documents. You go back to the sources. You go back to the original documents, and you say, brothers, if we're going to save Islam from this fracturing phenomenon that we're seeing, where there are all these different interpretations, that we got to go back to the original documents, the Quran and the Hadith. Wahhabism's main area of influence is Saudi Arabia. Ibn Abd al-Wahhab was invited to settle in neighboring Saudi Arabia by its ruler, Muhammad ibn Saud. Now, remember I said Arabian society is tribal. The House of Sauds has become one of the big tribes right now at this point, 1740, around this. The House of Saud is one of the main tribes. And so its leader has become a ruler in Arabia, and his name is Muhammad ibn Saud. In 1740, he makes this agreement with the Wahhabists. Upon arriving in Diriyah, a pact was made between Ibn Saud and Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, by which Ibn Saud pledged to implement and enforce Wahhab's teaching, while Ibn Saud and his family would remain the temporal leaders of the Wahhabist movement. And the Wahhabists give their support to the House of Saud and basically say, you are the keepers of the mosque. And actually, the House of Saud, just like the royals in England, the king or the queen in England is called the defender of the faith. There's a story behind that. The House of Saud in Arabia is now called the keepers of the mosque. It is the House of Saud that is in charge of maintaining the security, defense, and the state of the two great mosques in Medina and Mecca. And from that, they have derived the power and the status to be the royal family of Arabia, which is why we now call it Saudi Arabia. And from that, they derive their great influence in the Islamic world. even though there are some factions that hate the House of Saud because of their dealings with the West, still, the House of Saud is the main, one of the main influences and protectors of Islam, because they are the keepers of the mosques. So you have this treaty, basically, or this agreement between the Wahhabis and the House of Saud, where they both benefit and they both now have influence. And the Wahhabist reform movement now is officially supported by the House of Saud. And they have continued to do that. They have continued to support Wahhabism around the world. Ah, there we go. In the early 20th century, the Wahhabist-oriented Al Saud dynasty conquers and unifies the various provinces of the Arabian Peninsula, founding the modern-day Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in 1932. This provides the movement with a state of vast wealth from oil discovered in the following decades, coupled with Saudi control of the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, have since provided a base and a funding for the Wahhabist missionary activity that has even come to America and has been vastly influential around the world. What about Salafism? Salafism is also a reform movement. The principal tenet of Salafism is that Islam was perfect and complete during the days of Muhammad and his Sahaba or companions, but that undesirable innovations have been added over the later centuries due to materialist and cultural influences, particularly Western influences. Salafism seeks to revive a practice of Islam that more closely resembles the religion during the time of Muhammad. Salafism's main area of influence comes from Egypt. Salafist Sayyid Qutb and Hassan al-Banna reacted to both the decadence of Western culture and the secularism of the Egyptian government, going back to Gamal Abdul Nasser, who was the dictator in Egypt when I was a kid. So it's going back a little ways. Salafist ideology gave rise to the Muslim Brotherhood, a radical group established to fight against secular governments in Islamic countries. And this is a picture of Hassan al-Banna, 1906 to 1949, when he died. And a picture of Sayyid Qutb, who spent much of his life in prison. The secular governments of Egypt tried many times to destroy the Muslim Brotherhood, and they never succeeded. And finally, the Muslim Brotherhood did succeed. But he died in 1966. Not a pathetic-looking guy, but he was actually educated in America. And that's where he reacted against Western culture. He thought American culture was entirely decadent and wicked and couldn't wait to get back to Egypt. And he started this, was one of the principal founders of the Salafist movement. Many people think Salafism or link Salafism and Wahhabism together because they have similar origins and theology. And that's true because they're both reform movements. And they're both trying to recapture Islam in a prior state of purity that they don't see today. Both of these ideologies are more and more influential in Islam. Those who call for a reformation within Islam do not understand that Wahhabism and Salafism are already reform movements. They've had their reformation. I remember watching Sean Hannity one night. And Sean said, you know, Christian Church had a reformation. Now, he's a loyal Catholic, but I thought that was an interesting reference. Christianity had a reformation. It's time for Islam to have a reformation. And I was shouting at the television, which I often do. Carry on. And I always win those debates for some reason. But I'm shouting at Sean saying, they've had their reformation. It's not going well. Okay? What is a reformation? See, we have this concept that reformation is just a change. But what is a reformation? It's a return. What was the Protestant Reformation? It was a return to the scriptures. It was a return to apostolic teaching. It was a return to biblical doctrine. It wasn't just a change. And reformations are not just changes, they are returns. So Islam has had two reform movements in the last few centuries. One, the Wahhabist movement was first, the Salafist movement second. They've had reformations, and it's not going well. So those reformations bring them back to their original state. That's where their goal is. Isn't it interesting that as a religion goes back to its original state, it becomes more violent? That's what's happening in these reforms. Yes?
What do you mean it's not going well?
Not going well for us.
Oh. I mean, they're becoming more violent? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. These two movements are mm-hmm. two very important movements that have led to the modern jihadist mentality and jihadist programs that we're dealing with right now. Saudi connection. The royal family, under the agreement with the Wahhabi sect, is the keeper of the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. Saudi royal family funds thousands of Wahhabi-oriented schools around the world, even in the U.S. The Saudi regime also funds the Islamic takeover of mosques all around the world, including the U.S. Where do the Saudis get the money to do this? Three-letter word. Oil. Oil. When the shale oil fields were opening up in, what was it, North Dakota, it is, and Texas, new technologies and new techniques of drawing oil, I said, wow, this could be very important, not just for the supply of oil, but for liberating us from dependence on Middle Eastern oil. I really hope that somebody gets that idea. We need to develop these supplies of oil so that not so much of our money is going to Saudi Arabia. It's a fantasy to think that we're going to ever outgrow our need for oil. We won't. We may eventually develop technologies that can help us, but we're never going to actually get away from our need for oil. And developing other sources is actually a key part in this conflict that we should be pursuing. Look at the areas of Islamist growth in recent years. Iran with the Iranian Revolution. Pakistan is now largely an Islamist nation. Turkey is becoming more and more Islamist, as Afghanistan and Iraq. You might say, but we fought in Afghanistan. I thought we kicked the Taliban out. Well, they're still around and they're still fighting. Didn't we liberate Iraq from Saddam Hussein? Yeah, but you know, they're still fighting ISIS there. And guess what? This is more troubling even than the fact that there's still a Taliban and we're fighting ISIS in Iraq and Libya and Syria and so on. When we went in and defeated the Taliban with the help of the Northern Alliance, and we defeated Saddam Hussein, what did we do? We sought to establish a democratic government in these countries. So we held elections. Guess what the end result of those elections were? The institution of Sharia in both Iraq and Afghanistan. These two countries, bought and paid for by your tax dollars and your blood, now have Sharia law as their form of government, as their, and courtesy of Uncle Sam, because we had free elections there. And they went the Islamist way in many respects. Now, they're still kind of on the fence in some areas. It's all is not lost yet. But look at their legal code. They adopted Sharia as their legal code, which means they are, for worse, committed to this path. And government by Sharia. Indonesia, Somalia, Chad and the Sudan, Ethiopia and Eritrea are all countries right now that either have fallen to Islamist forces or are being severely attacked and oppressed by Islamic forces. Look in the United States, the rise of homegrown terrorism, the rise of Islamist mosques, the rise of Islamist cities, Minneapolis, Detroit, Dearborn, all have significant Muslim populations out of which many of these homegrown terrorists have come or have some kind of a connection to those cities. The influence within the U.S. Government itself, again, under our political correctness, where you know the army captain who went shot up the people at Fort Hood. You know, he was a psychologist, and part of his work as an army psychologist, part of the work that he did was to develop a PowerPoint presentation on integrating Islam into the army. And he explained the basic tenets of Islam. And in I've seen his presentation. It was available for a little while on the web. I don't know if you can still find it. But I watched his presentation. He's quite clear about the necessity of violent jihad. And this was all done under the auspices of the United States Army. And then he went and actually put it into practice. When he took out his gun and began shooting American soldiers, he was simply putting into practice what he put into his PowerPoint. And yet, how many of you ever heard that? How many of you have ever heard that? You haven't. Political correctness is at work there. Can the advance be stopped? Big question. I'm not sure. I will tell you, I do not think the advance can be stopped until we start dealing honestly with it. You cannot defeat an enemy that you refuse to acknowledge properly. And you will not understand your enemy when you refuse to acknowledge the nature of the enemy. Not all Muslims are the enemy. By the way, there are many Muslims. I talk about that army captain who shot up the soldiers at Fort Hood. But there are many Muslims serving in our armed forces right now who are, in fact, fighting jihad. Remember that. You always got to keep your balance here. There are many Muslims who have given their lives in the fight against jihad as American military personnel. A little balance. Remember, you want to actually love them into the kingdom. That's the ultimate goal. But we've still got to deal with this issue of jihad. We need to acknowledge the nature. The problem is not a radical misinterpretation of Islam. The problem is in the religion itself. You and I, as non-Muslims, can't fix the religion. We can evangelize. We have to defend our nation, our people. But it's going to be up to Muslims to confront the nature of their own religion. And if there is some change possible, and I'm not even sure that's possible, it's going to have to come within Islam itself to challenge their own religion. And of course, many of them will then be seen as apostates and suffer rejection and persecution and maybe even lose their lives as they do that. But it's you and I, as non-Muslims, are not going to be able to change their religion. We maybe can put pressure. But the changes, if there are changes possible, are going to have to come within Islam. David, you looked like you were getting ready to say something.
Yeah.
Okay, quick questions. Just a few. Quick questions. Yes?
Do women have the same obligations as men? Muslim men, you know, to do the...
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure I'd say the same obligations, but you are seeing a phenomenon more and more where women are coming out committed to violent jihad, and there have been several cases where women are the ones that are strapping on the explosive vests and martyring themselves. That phenomenon seems to be happening more and more, and I wouldn't say they have the same obligation in Islamic teaching, but it's something that's being encouraged right now. So, as far as I understand Islamic teaching. Interesting. Oh, question. Yeah, Chuck.
Can you raise something about historic Presbyterianism and missions to Islam?
Very difficult. Didn't you? Were you the one that mentioned the title of that book or something? Oh, that was to India. Maybe that was you or somebody else, or
somebody mentioned
Indians.
Indians.
Was the
noble savages or something like that. Well, yeah, we had, you know, when I grew up, my own personal experience, when I grew up, there were women, which I always thought was interesting, that in our denomination, the Bible Presbyterian Church, it seemed like all our missionaries to Muslim countries were women. And I started wondering, how's that going to work?
Yeah.
You know, how are they going to be? It is very difficult. It is very difficult. And several of these women that I knew, they would come home and they would give their missionary reports in church and so on. They had been there 20 and 30 years laboring on the field in Islamic countries and maybe had five converts. A handful of converts over that lengthy period of time. I think part of the problem is they were women and there's an inherent prejudice against a woman teaching them and so on.
Well, what about
but you still can find that same phenomenon with men.
What about Samuel Svaber?
You're going to have to tell me about that one.
Samuel Svaber, and then the apostle to the Muslims.
Oh, okay.
Early
go ahead.
1900s, Presbyterian.
Yeah, I'm not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very famous about that. He wrote a book on the fact that Allah and the Christian God are the same. Although he wasn't evangelical,
yeah,
he was saying. At that point, he says if you're going to evangelize, the Muslim recognize that their notion of monotheism, our notion of monotheism, is the same, and then the Trinity kind of makes the difference. But otherwise, that's how he argued.
Yeah, I would say he's still wrong about that. You know, it's very tempting to try to find some common ground. Where I think of this is an application of Vantillian apologetic and so on, Vantil's teaching. We do have a common ground in our human experience, the mannishness of man. And that's our common ground. That's why I emphasize we're all image bearers and we all share a large set of common experiences, even in different religions. I think that's where you make your approach. To the difference between the Islamic concept of God and the Christian concept of God goes way beyond the name you use to describe God. Obviously, there's the Trinitarian issue, but it's also the Islamic concept of Allah is very arbitrary. There's no concept of a covenant that binds God to his people. There's an arbitrariness. There is a place, and I forget whether it's in the Quran or another Islamic writing, where Allah is described as the greatest of deceivers. The greatest of deceivers. And he has the right to deceive you if he wants to. Yeah.
Okay, Don's going to take the last one, and then because we do have young people, I know Alan's not going to split right away, so if you do have questions for Alan, feel free to ask. But
spring break over.
I'm sorry?
Is spring break
over? Yeah, spring break is over. We've got kids that need to get back. But go ahead, Donna.
Well, forgive me for saying it like this, but aren't you really just arguing against yourself then, the commonness of God in arguing with a Muslim? Because the basic premise to Vantil would be you first got to accept the God of the Bible.
Well, yeah.
And then we get to work. And if they don't accept, if Allah is their God, and you try and compare the commonalities of those two gods still, they have to accept the God of the Bible before you can argue from Vantil's position.
Well, they have to accept the God of the Bible, which is your ultimate goal, but compromising that by saying, you know, we can call our God Allah as the same God. That's not the God of the Bible. So you've already conceded a major element, a major truth claim of Christianity by saying Allah and God are the same.
Well, then I misunderstood you because I thought you said that instead of the way Schwenger would approach it, I thought you were saying you would argue it from a monotheistic point of view. And the commonness there of monotheism.
No, the commonness is in our humanness,
man's image,
our image bearingness. That's where the commonness is.
But if you don't first accept the God of the Bible, you can't understand the humanness. You can't understand the image of God.
But we do share many things with non-believers as part of our humanness. When you start talking about God, you've got to argue the God of the Bible.
Right.
That's what your goal is, to get the Muslim or whoever it is to accept God as he is taught and presented in Scripture. My point was, in response to Chuck's question, is that if you start with this idea that Allah is just another name for God, but we really worship the same God, you've already conceded this doctrine of the God of the Bible. You obscured the God of the Bible, and therefore you basically shot yourself in the foot from the very beginning. And you're going to have to undo that whole concession that you've made at some point to get back to the God of the Bible. You've actually made that's what.
Well, that's what I thought you were saying.
Yeah,
that was what I was saying.
Our commonness is not a common a common concept of God. Our commonness is in our humanness and our the fact that we are created in this image.
But I still say you can't understand that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's quickly close in prayer.
Go
ahead, David.
Again, Alan, thank you for being here.
Thank you
for all the time. And let's pray. Father, ultimately, we do recognize that we can't change the hearts and the minds of men. We are responsible to live for Jesus, to speak for Jesus whenever that opportunity arises. And help us not to be cowardly, but to be bold in our witness for him. Particularly, Father, when in your providence we meet those who are apart from Christ and who are steeped in the falsehood of Islam. We pray, Father, that the things that we've heard today will be helpful to that end. We do ask, Father, also that you would indeed cause many who are blinded by this false religion to turn in faith to the Lord Jesus. Father, bless us as we continue to fellowship tonight. Thank you for the privilege of being with one another throughout the day. We pray that this week we would indeed live for Jesus. We remember the things that we've been told. We would take seriously our call to be your people. And we pray in Jesus' name.